Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. You ain't gonna be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for at least. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money, major corporations who got the money. That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk only control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly. They can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. Even though you only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March for what? Who cares? Marching never changed anything.
Oh,
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But, man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank a three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles. The kid no one would pick. Was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Now, learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said this man that went to heaven, and he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and it was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. And mess around, he saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he's here. He said, nah, I won't know what's in the door. He said, you sure you won't see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And in the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him, and then you felt like you wasn't worthy, and so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room, and I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me, and I said, I want you to do this graph for me, and that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you're having is when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on not meant to be way, because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on pity way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off, because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she's been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin if he will come. Listen to me. Rich people think differently. So what I'm going to put in your head today is a rich people concept, so you can get to understand it. The only difference between successful people and not is just how they think. Rich people think different. Quit letting people tell you got to get qualified in another program. You don't need another program to be successful. You need to change the way you think. So here's the deal. The problem with becoming a millionaire is that when you decide that you want to be a millionaire, you immediately start thinking, how can I become a millionaire? Well, that thought don't just pop into your head, so you get frustrated and you don't become a millionaire. And you start creating stuff like, well, I guess this wasn't the Lord's will. Or as soon as I think of how I'm going to make a million. You can't think of how to make $1 million. Stop. Do you know if you knew how to make $1 million? What's the day? Tuesday? Wouldn't you make it by Friday? Wouldn't you make it by Friday? But suppose I told you how you can become a millionaire with what you have. Because here's the deal. All of you have everything it takes to become rich. You just don't believe it. Now, if you can develop this theory that I'm about to share with you, I have the way for you to be rich. This is it. First of all of you have a gift. God gave it to you when he created you. God never created a single soul without giving them a gift. That's the God that created you. He's a very smart God. Here's the cold thing. When he made you, he put the gift inside of you. He didn't hide it under the ocean. It ain't on the mountain nowhere. It ain't under no rocks. You ain't got to go drilling. God put what you needed inside of you at birth. All of you have a gift. But you have got to do your gift, the thing God gave you at birth to do. It is the thing that you do the absolute best with the least amount of effort. That's your gift. Anything else you doing, you wasting your time. Do you hear me? You wasting your time. If when the alarm clock goes off in the morning and it makes you sick every morning that alarm go off, it's because you ain't doing your gift. You're going against what God created you to be. Do most of you know what your gift is? Who in here doesn't know their gift yet? Okay, let me tell you what you do. Go home today. Don't talk to nobody. Sit down and have one conversation with yourself. What is the thing that I do the absolute best with the least amount of effort? This ain't going to take you long. You old enough, you grown. Write it down. I don't care if it's networking. I don't care if it's babysitting. I don't care if it's doing color. I don't care if it's painting. Whatever it is, it's what you do. Sing it. Whatever you do the best, write it down. That's your gift. That's it. You ain't got to go asking a bunch of people. They've been telling you your whole life. You know, you ever have people call you with their problems? They always call you with your problems because you gifted at it. But you didn't know how to identify it. If you identify your gift. Now, let me ask you this question. This thing that you're gifted at, if you did it for somebody, do you think somebody would pay you $10 for your gift? Just $10. Could you babysit for $10? Could you cut somebody's hair for $10? Could you cut their grass for $10? Could you make them a chicken dinner for $10? Could you do something for $10? Everybody, don't you have something somebody would give you $10 for? Okay, now, once you have something that somebody's willing to pay you $10 for, this is how this works. It's called the multiples of 10. See, you don't have to figure out how to be a millionaire. You just got to figure out the thing that makes you $10. So now here we go. You do it and you make $10. Soon as they pay you the 10, go do it 10 more times. Whatever it was. Watch some more kids. 10 more times. Get another 10. You got $100. When you get $100, whatever you did to make that $100, listen to me, do it 10 more times. You ain't got to get tricky with it. Just do it 10 more times. You'd have made $1,000. Whatever you did to make the $1,000, don't get smart. Stay stupid now. Do it 10 more times. You have now made $10,000. Hold up. Now we finna grow a little bit, but guess what you got to do to grow? You just got to do some more. Whatever you made $10,000 doing, I need you to do it 10 more times. What you tripping for? If you do it 10 more times, you got $100,000. Now, you might have to hire some people to make this happen. You got to figure that part out. But all you got to do is do what you did for $10. Once you make $100,000, uh-oh, if you just do it 10 more times. I used to spend the night in hotel parking lots. What was I going to do? I ain't had nowhere to stay, so I lived in the car. I had $35. And I said, come on, God, man, I've been trying to make this dream come true. You done left me out here like this. And I was crying so hard that he just said, I didn't like hear a voice or nothing, but he spoke to me. And however, he said, if you get up, I'm going to take you places you ain't never been. Now, I was finna quit. So I said, skip it. I'm going to quit anyway. So I got in my car. I went to a payphone. And I was going to call my dad. You remember back in the day where you could punch in a code and call your answering machine and get your messages? So I called and I punched in the code and the said, doop. He said, hey, Steve, this is Chuck Sutton with Showtime at the Apollo. We saw a tape of you. You're very funny. If you could get here Sunday night, we'd love to put you on television. Call me back. Let me know if you can make it. So I hung the phone up. I'm crushed because my whole dream of being on TV, and I couldn't get to New York. I got $35. How am I going to get to New York? I can't make it. So I'm standing there at the phone booth and tears just coming down my face. I said, God, so that must be a sign for me to go home. Because this is it. I ain't even got the money to go to the Apollo. My whole thing, wanting to be on TV, I couldn't even make the dream come true. This is the most messed up moment. And so I said, man, let me call this dude back and see if he said this Sunday. Because maybe he said next Sunday and I could hustle up a little bit of money or something. I don't know what I'm going to do, but let me just call him back. So I call him back. Steve, this is Chuck Sutton, Showtime at the Apollo. We saw a tape of yours. You're very, very funny. Look, we have an opening Sunday night at Showtime at the Apollo. If you can make it, we'd love to put you on TV. I said, it's this Sunday. Before I hit the button, I heard, doop, you have another message. Now, it wasn't there before. So I punched my code in. I listened to the second message. It said, Steve Harvey, this is Tom Sober from the Comedy Caravan. This is a Thursday. He said, I have a gig in Jacksonville, Florida on Friday night that pays $150. If you can get there Friday night, you'll make $150. So I called him back. And I said, hey, Tom, did you get a gig away? He said, no, it's still available. He said, can you get there? I said, I'm in Pensacola, Florida. I'm 3.5 hours away. So I drive to Jacksonville, Florida. And that night, I made the 150. The club owner said, man, you're funnier than the guy we hired. If you stay tomorrow night, I'm going to give you another $150. So now I got $300 now. So I get on the phone, I call Chuck Sutton, I say, hey man, is the gig still available at Showtime at the Apollo? He said, yeah, we got one opening left. I said, I'll be there. So I call Eastern Airlines, who used to be open back then. They had a special for $99 going from Jacksonville, Florida to New York round trip. So I parked my car at the airport. I got it. Got on a plane, flew. Everything I had was in two bags. Got to the Apollo. I said, hey, man, I'm here. I got there at 11 o'clock in the morning. He said, you can't stay here because you don't come on to the late show tonight. I said, man, I ain't got nowhere to go. I said, if you just let me stay in this building, man, I ain't gonna move around nothing. I ain't got nowhere to go. I'm in Harlem. I can't go back out here. I got these two bags. I got victim wrote all over me, man. So he said, all right, if you go upstairs, don't come down. So he put me in the dressing room on the 6th floor. So that's where all the comedians were. So I stayed up there. I got hungry around 3 o'clock, man. I couldn't take it no more. So I went back downstairs, a dude named Alton Liston. I said, hey, man, he said, man, I thought I told you, don't come down them damn steps. I said, hey, man, I'm just hungry, man. I said, let me go to that KFC I saw on the corner. Just let me get some chicken. I'll come right back. He said, man, if you ain't back in 20 minutes, you ain't getting in this building. So I went, bought me some chicken, came back. So the comedians started coming in the building. They started coming up on the 6th floor. So I meet this guy named D.L. Hughley. I introduce myself. He introduced himself. I'm sitting there. Another guy come in named Dwayne Johnson. Then this other dude walked in named Jamie Foxx. And I introduced myself. We don't know each other. Ain't none of us famous. It's 1991, man. They gave everybody the lineup. I was on the last show of the night. I don't go on to 11 at night. I'd have had this 4 pieces of chicken. I'm starving, man. That chicken didn't wore off. I'm nervous, man. I'm about to throw up. D.L. Hughley went downstairs. D.L. Hughley got booed off. Dwayne Johnson got booed off. Jamie Foxx went down there and got booed. They booed Jamie. Then Jamie started singing. And then they started clapping. And Jamie had their ass. Then he went back to them jokes. And they got his ass. So I'm walking down the steps and I see Jamie sitting on the steps. I said, hey, man, hang in there. He said, man, that ain't never happened to me before, man. This is crazy. This Jamie Foxx, man, one of the most talented people in all of comedy. And now, you don't even know how nervous I am, man. I can't even. My breathing is shot because these dudes been booed. So I walk out. I had wrote this joke. Mike Tyson had got in a fight in Harlem with this heavyweight named Mitch Green. Mike Tyson had hit the dude in the eye in the store. Now, he was on the news. His eye was swollen. So the joke I wrote was they was interviewing Mitch Green, and he was telling everybody what happened, but his eye took over the interview. And I wrote this joke that his eye started talking and was just, I tell you what happened. The heavyweight champ's fist is coming towards my face. I just say, Lord, Lord, Lord. And I wrote this whole joke about this dude's eyeball talking. And when the punch came, and all this here, the Apollo, man, they went crazy. They lost their mind. I got a standing ovation, man. I walked off stage. I walked off stage, man, just started crying. I couldn't believe it. They paid me. I made $750 for being on TV for one night. I had never made $750 telling jokes in one night. And so that was my first television appearance. A couple weeks later, Sinbad was the host of the show. He got this job on Different World. And so he quit. And so Mark Curry became the host. And then Mark Curry got hanging with Mr. Cooper, and he quit. And they came to me and said, would you come back to New York and host Amateur Night for us to just try you out? Oh, ain't no problem. And so I went to New York. I hosted Amateur Night, and I was killing. But every time we went to commercial break, I was supposed to let the warm-up act take over like Ruben does. But I knew not to let the warm-up act do that because he would change the attitude of the crowd because Apollo was a wild place. So I stayed out there. I did the warm-up and the hosting. And I created a bond with that audience. And that's how I got on TV. It was my very first TV show. I hosted Showtime at Apollo. I ended up being the longest-running host in the history of Showtime. I did that show for 8 years. Nobody ever did it for 8 years. And that was my turn-back moment. See, in your life, everybody has a turn back moment. You have a moment where you can go forward or you can give up. But the thing you have to keep in mind before you give up is that if you give up, the guarantee is it will never happen. That's the guarantee of quitting, that it will never happen, no way under the sun. The only way the possibility remains that it can happen is if you never give up, no matter what. Because God is always coming. He's never too late. At your worst moment, look, man, when they told me I had to be in New York, I saw no way I could get there. But that God, though, he make the phone ring. I end up in Florida. I make $300. Then I go to New York. I make $750. Almost got $1,000 out of nowhere. That's what happened to me. That was my moment of never giving up. That's when I first learned that faith was everything, that you have to remain faithful.
Because I used to observe that a lot of those shacks used to be by the track where black people were.
With the room in the back.
Yes, with the room in the back. That was a safety net.
Yeah.
Where black people who would move here and there and go from here and there looking for jobs, that's usually why we move, and the jobs would play out like they always did.
And do.
But we had a place to go when the sun went down. But now, those shacks by the track don't exist anymore. They came and built highways right alongside of those railroad tracks where those shacks used to be. Superhighways. So now, if you get on a highway, you might notice that sometimes you are right alongside of a railroad track. You see trains passing
that
as you are driving.
That is true.
Down a superhighway.
Mm-hmm.
Well, see, those highways used not to be there. in the northwestern hemisphere. It used to be shacks along there. A lot of those shacks were on what we call railroad property. But the railroad people, the people that ran the railroads, didn't care much because nobody wanted to be down. That wasn't prime real estate.
No.
Nobody wanted to be by the tracks anyway. So black people used to build those shacks around there back when black people knew how to build shacks. Black people don't know how to build anything now because they used to build places for white people, but they cut them off with things called unions, took them out, took the carpentry all out of the schools and all like that. So how many black people do you know how to fix anything now? It used to be thousands and millions of black people that know how to build a house from scratch out of old pieces of lumber.
Wow.
A lot of people don't remember that. Most people are not that old to have seen it done.
Hmm.
I, coming along, I'm old enough to remember when many black people used to get together on a Saturday afternoon. That was the only time they had off, or sometimes, or on a Sunday sometimes after church. They would get together, six or eight of them, and go down and build what they call a shotgun house. It wasn't much, but it was a roof over your head, a good solid roof. I've been in some of those houses, raised up in some, all right? They were excellent, solid houses that could stand a lot of storm and rain. They weren't much, just maybe three rooms. But I've been in some of them, and there were many, 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 many of them. But along came the white supremacists and say, these Negroes know how to build stuff. We're going to fix that so the next generation won't know how to do anything except stand in front of a place that is built and big, because they won't know anything about carpentry or masonry or how to make anything with their hands.
From the chesswebsite.com, and today I'm going to be covering my favorite topic in chess, and that is chess gambits. Ever since I was a kid, I loved playing chess gambits. Could be because Gambit was my favorite character on X-Men cartoons, or it could be because I loved giving up material in chess and then almost turning it into a puzzle. How can I give up material and then find an advantage for my setup? I just love that. So I made a video on my top eight favorite chess gambits. Now, it is subjective, so I want to give you the criteria that went into it. The first one is how often you're going to get to play this gambit. There's some obscure gambits that people like out there, but they just never come up. I like gambits that I can play anytime I want to because the positions are always coming up in my chess games. And the next one is how much fun the gambit is. I like to look at my opponent's face and just have them confused, trying to figure out why in the world I would play the moves that I'm making. So hopefully you guys enjoy this video. If you have other gambits that you really, really like, feel free to put those in the comment section below. But I think you'll find some on this video that you may not be familiar with. Also, for the first time in 10 years, we're going to try this out. If you wouldn't mind subscribing to the channel if you're not already and hitting the like button. Again, first time in 10 years, hundreds of videos, never asked for people to do that. But just curious to see how many people we can actually like this video and subscribe to the channel. So without further ado, hopefully you guys enjoy my top 8 chess gambits. Coming in at number 8, we have the Schliemann Gambit, which starts out with the Ray Lopez with e4, e5, knight f3, knight c6, bishop to b5. And usually in the Ray Lopez, black's looking to play a6, looking to play knight to f6. But in the Schliemann Gambit, black plays f5, says, I'm going to completely disrupt everything white is looking to do. White can't continue in the same game plan. How do they really continue from here? It looks logical to take this material. That's completely fine. It's what black wants. Black can now push forward with e4. This knight can't come to g5 or h4. It's just going to fall to the queen. If it comes back to g1, that feels really weird. All of a sudden you have d1. The bishop can take here on f5. So all in all, white doesn't have nearly the setup that they were hoping for in the Ray Lopez. All of a sudden, black is really looking to dominate the center of the board. So if you haven't played the Schliemann Gambit, it is a fun way to counter the Ray Lopez. Coming in at number 7, we have the Tennyson Gambit, which starts out with e4, d5. And I feel like any time black plays this, they almost for sure know that white's going to take here on d5. But what if they don't? What if they play the Tennyson Gambit, which is knight to f3, and says, hey, I don't mind if you take this. I'm going to bring my knight up here to g5, attacking this. Now, they could just say, I'm going to completely ignore that. I don't know what you're up to. Great, you can just come back here and take with your knight. If they try to hold on to this, well, then you can start to get pretty aggressive with bishop to c4. You can see the knight on g5 is already attacking this square here on f7, which is extremely weak. It's only defended by the king here that's on e8 right now. So a lot of strong attacks. They can defend it in many different ways, but white has a strong attack depending on where they move. So that is the The Tennyson Gambit always catches your opponent off guard. Coming at number 6, we have the Halloween Gambit, one of my favorites as a kid because it was the first gambit I played where I wasn't just giving up a pawn. I was actually giving up a knight, a minor piece, so that always intrigued me. Starts out with e4, e5, knight f3, knight c6, and then usually gets into the four knights game with knight to c3, knight f6, and then the knight takes here on e5. So exchanging a knight for a pawn after the knight takes, then white starts the offensive attack in the center of the board, pawn to d4. Usually the knight's going to come back to c6, and it can just continue to attack. Knight down here to e5, pawn pushes forward, really just needs to come back here to g6. White can push forward again, knight moves back here. So you can see black is up material, but white has a strong presence in the center of the board. If you haven't ever played the Halloween Gambit, I highly recommend it. Always fun to give up a minor piece early on and then see if you can turn that into a win. Coming in at number 5, we have the Colorado Gambit, which starts out with e4, knight to c6, and then knight to f3. Or it could also start with the knight coming here to f3 first, and then the pawn here to e4. But either way, it's black's move, and the common response is not what we're going to play. That would be something like e5, bishop down here to b5. This gets into the Ruy Lopez, which you could always play the Schliemann Gambit in this if you wanted to. But the Colorado Gambit says we're not even playing e5. We're just going to immediately attack here with f5. So very similar to the Schliemann Gambit, looking to attack the center of the board with the f pawn. Knowing that later on you could castle on the king side, you could have your rook here on the semi-open f-file at some point. Black has a lot of strong attacks, but they never expect you to play this f5. Now if they push forward, that's going to be completely fine. You can start to disrupt the center of the board. This opens up lines for your light square bishop to get involved into the game to take away their center pawn here. If they don't take, maybe they get their bishop involved into the game. Then you can just take their pawn. If they decide to go ahead and take, well, you can just start to push in the center of the board. They've lost their center pawn. So you have a lot of attacking lines in the Colorado game. It's definitely a good way to disrupt your opponent when they start out with e4. Knight f3. Coming at number 4, we have the Jerome Gambit, one of the more aggressive lines that you'll see in this video series, but it starts out with e4, e5, knight f3, knight to c6. You can tell what type of games I play a lot of, but instead of the bishop coming to b5, the bishop's going to come to c4. And most common response is bishop down here to c5, and here's where things start to get tricky. The bishop takes on f7, sacrifices material, and said, I'm going to give up my bishop for the pawn so that I can start to attack my opponent's king. Now, they don't have to take the bishop, but if they don't, that's just weird. Like, you should tell them to go ahead and take it because they're going to lose if they don't take it. But once they take it, that allows you to continue with the Jerome Gambit. And that says, I haven't given up enough material. I'm going to give up more. I'm going to go ahead and play knight to e5. This is check. They pretty much have to take with their knight. There's no real reason for them not to. But after they take with their knight, then queen to h5. And this is where the fun begins. So you can tell you've given up a lot of material already, a knight and a bishop, but you have a strong attack. There are kings out in the center, and you can start to have some fun. So if you haven't played the Jerome Gambit, I highly recommend it. Coming at number 3, we have the Steinitz Gambit, which starts out with e4, e5, but changing things up a little bit, and that is knight to c3. Most players just assume white's going to, if they're going to play a knight, come here to f3, but you don't always have to. You can play knight to c3, and many times black will just respond with the same thing. They'll go ahead and play knight to c6. They all just marry him, not exactly sure what you're doing, and then you can play f4, and this is where the fun begins in the Steinitz Gambit. After they take here, white's really just looking to dominate the center of the board. That's the main theme of this opening. But after d4, black can start to attack and play queen down here to h4, and the king has to come to e2. You're not going to play pawn here. because then after the pawn takes, you're just giving up more material, and the pawn can't recapture because the rook is going to fall. The king has to come here to e2, and this looks really awkward because the king is blocking this light square bishop, and it no longer castle to either side of the board, but it actually works out extremely well for white. The knight's going to come here to f3 pretty soon, chase the queen around, while black's busy moving his queen, not doing anything productive. White's over here developing the center of the board, getting all his minor pieces developed into the game, chasing black around. It's a very, very good gambit, and white has a lot of attacking lines that may not look like it when you just look at this board setup right here. Coming in at number two, we have the Cochran gambit, and that starts out with e4, e5. Don't judge me. I play a lot of e4 games, and there's a lot of gambits that come out of this. Knight to f3, and then knight to f6. So sometimes black will try the Petrov defense, which is this right here, thinking that they can catch white off guard, and it normally continues with knight to e5, and then the pawn comes to d6, and the knight comes back to f3, and then the knight takes here, and then we continue on the board. But what if white says, not today, I'm not going to retreat, I'm going to continue my attack, and that's exactly what the Cochran gambit does, and the knight takes here on f7. Now, after the king takes, if they don't take, that's just weird. You're going to take this rook. You're going to take the queen. Bad things are going to happen. So after they take here, then white's going to play d4. Because this opens up all the lines. The queen is online. The light square bishop's online. Now the dark square bishop's online. It's also giving up another pawn and material. If they want to take that, that's fine. Queen can come over here to h5. This square is no longer protected, attacking the king. The queen can swing over here depending on where the king goes to, can get both the bishops involved. Things are extremely bad for black. Definitely a fun way. Anytime someone tries the Petrov, this is always my go-to because it catches them off guard. They just always expect the knight to come back here to f3. But then just to see them after I played knight to f7 and realize that they're going to get their king chased around the board for the rest of the game. Coming in at number one, we have the Muzio gambit, and yes, it derives from the King's gambit, but I felt like it was almost cheating to have number one being the King's gambit because I always do videos on the King's gambit. Most of you know that that is my favorite opening, but this is a specific variation in the King's gambit that is my favorite. Anytime I get the opportunity to play it, I absolutely will. The King's gambit, for those not familiar, e4, e5, f4, and then after the pawn recaptures, knight to f3. Now, the Muzio gambit really needs them to come down with the g5, which many times they will. They're start to attack on the king side of the board. This protects this pawn and start to add pressure on this g4 square. Sometimes in the king's gambit, you'll play h4, so that then when they come down here to g4, you have an outpost. You can start to attack, get your light square bishop over here to c4 and attack the f7 square. But that's not what the Muzio gambit's looking to do. Says, I don't even care about that. I'm just going to start developing my material. And so if they push forward, this is where it gets even more fun because you're just going to castle on a king side. You don't even care about the knight. After they take with their pawn, you're going to recapture with your queen. So you can see you have your most powerful piece involved into the game. You have your bishop here eyeing down on the weakest square. You've already castled. You have a rook open on the semi-open file. They can't castle on the king side and have king safety. Their g pawn is gone. They have no pieces developed. You can easily push forward here with a d4 and get your dark square bishop involved into the game. So anytime I play the king's gambit, although I don't know what my opponent's going to do, the Muzio gambit is my number one go-to if I have the opportunity to play it. So that is my list of top 8 chess gambits. Hopefully you guys enjoyed this video. Again, if you haven't already, please subscribe to the video. And if you liked this list and want to see more, feel free to give me a thumbs up. Also, if you have a gambit that I did not cover, that you want to let people know about that you enjoy playing, feel free to leave that in the comments. If you have other chess video ideas, you can always contact me at email, thechesswebsite@gmail.com. That is the best way to reach out to me. But thank you guys so much for watching, and I will see you in the next video.
All right, today we can do open mic or whatever you guys want to talk about, but I want to talk about something, and we're going to do a series on this. probably not only throughout the year, but year after year. The title of today's live stream is titled Gentrification Chess, Geese, and Golden Eggs. Inspired by a court hearing that I sat in on this past Wednesday. Today is Friday, so a couple days ago. And let me start with the gentrification aspect of this. I was listening to some, matter of fact, Wednesday. You know, we usually start at 10:30 a.m. Central. I mean, it's not Central, Eastern Standard Time, but I had originally scheduled the regular time to be for this past Wednesday, 4:30 p.m., because I had to attend a court hearing Wednesday morning at 9:30, all done remotely, you know, these days. But then something told me, you know what, court hearings usually don't last that long, so let me switch it back to 10:30, which I did, and let's just see what happens. So I called into the, you know, the court thing, and about 8 to 10 minutes early, and they started right up on time at that 9:30. I was listening to the case I was interested in. They didn't call until about 10:20, about 10:20, somewhere around there. Or even 10:25, because I thought, you know what, man, I might have to, you know, bump the start time to, you know, 11 o'clock or something like that, you know. So, but I didn't have to. They called the case. So I was listening to about a solid 50 minutes of court cases. Now, this case is in Washington, D.C. These hearings are all in Washington, D.C. I primarily grew up in Washington, D.C. When I was in high school and college, D.C. Was known as Chocolate City. At least 70%, if not more, of the population of Washington, D.C., you know, 70s and 80s, were black folk, African American. Now, it's no longer Chocolate City. The black population has shrunk down from 70% or whatever in the 70s down to like maybe 45% African American. I think it's like 42% white. Then you got a sizable Latino community and Asians and whatnot. That's D.C. It is now, the way it is now. And in the 50 minutes that I was listening to court cases, I have a good sense of how the demographics have dramatically changed in Washington, D.C. Every defendant that, at least the 50 minutes that I listened in, every defendant was black, African American. About 70 to 75%, if not 80% of those, because I began taking notes after I noticed these patterns, were black women, and maybe, you know, you might have heard about two black men on it in that 50-minute period of time. I'm just using that as my metric. Okay. Every attorney that I heard online was white. You had a Latino judge. You have people on that call that got huge tax bills, liens on their property, not mortgages, family homes, all at risk of being lost. And looking at it, from what I've heard, and then seeing it, you know, how the city has dramatically changed, I call it urban genocide of the disappearing African-American ancestral home. Families members are not, for whatever reason, being able to hold on to these homes. Now, and we'll have to do, like I said, an extended podcast and some other events on urban genocide. This has nothing to do with violence. I mean, I'm talking about, you know, the shoot-ups and the shoot-em-ups and bang-bang. No, no guns, no knives, no bombs. Urban genocide when it comes to black ancestral homes in your major urban populated areas here in the United States. Now, the reason why I have in this title Gentrification Chess is because I know of three college-educated black folk that I personally know. Matter of fact, you know what? Let me not even pick on them that way. Let me throw these statistics out here. And I have this in the program notes here on Blog Talk Radio. Okay. In the game of chess, to start the game, you have 20 possible legal moves to make from the giddy up. That's if you're on the white side of the board, and you can look up what is similar in state nature for the black pawn. I mean the black piece as well. Whatever piece you want to move first. But there are 20 possible moves, or as the guy that I just played the audio, gambits. Now, after two moves, there are 400 possible moves that a player makes, has to select from after just two moves. To four moves, there are 197,742 possible moves after just four moves. And the common denominator of average moves that I've heard from black folks, not just this past Wednesday, but subtly, year after year, because this comes up, I just never really talked about it here on Ismail's. That's why we're going to make this into a regular thing, Gentrification Chess, which has absolutely nothing with white folks. The typical move or gambit that I hear when a black person is trying to save their house is particularly the ancestral house, mama's house, daddy's house. The house where if you sell it, You're killing the goose that laid the golden egg for generational wealth. This podcast was also inspired by, I got new next door neighbors in D.C. They're Asians. Nothing wrong with that. They paid $500,000 for the house. Like I said, we're neighbors. Literally next door. And the family that sold the house, the mother, the matriarch, who's 101 years old right now, she's in a nursing home put there by her daughter and her son. I used to go to school with the son when I was in, like, first grade. He was ahead of me by a year or two, though, but still, we both went to that same elementary school for, you know, starting out. So his sister, who was older than him, but between the two, they have children and grandchildren, and one might have a grandchild by now, a great-grand by now, I'm not sure. But they sold it for $500,000-plus. Now, I'm not in their business, don't want to be in their business, but I'm speculating. Well, let's look at what's happened so far. Number one, the ancestral house, mama's house, granddad's house, that's gone. That means their children and their grandchildren and their great-grandchild, whoever that might be, they have got to start off from zero. And that's what I call urban genocide. And it's done by our own people, by our own relatives, bloodline. Which is another reason why I am no fan personally, just me personally, of reparations. But so those kids and grandkids and great-grandkids, they've got to start off from zero. The matriarch of the family, who's 101 years old now, and her kids put her in a nursing home. You know, that $500,000, I think, will probably be gone within the next 36 months. 36 or 48, definitely 60 months, it'll be gone. Why? Because they killed the goose that laid the generational wealth egg. And that's why I titled today's podcast Chess, Geese. That house was a goose that laid golden eggs. The matriarch, who's in the nursing home right now, because they're going to use part of that $500,000 to bankroll that, with whatever time she's got left. She came up from South Carolina. I forgot where her husband came up from. He's been gone for many years anyway, but they came up and bought that house, started their family, and neither one of them had graduated from high school. My stepfather, who was alive, now, after she had raised, and let's call her Miss C. I don't want to give out a real name, but Mrs. C. After she had raised her daughter and was raising her other son, who I went to school with, about two years older than me, something like that. You know, they bought a house, but after they, long story short, my stepfather, put it this way, she did that, though, that couple, that black couple, bought a house, raised a family in a middle-class neighborhood with not even a GED. She was in her 40s. I'm guessing, I'm speculating. She was in her 40s when my stepfather helped her with math and helped her study to prepare to take the GED. She didn't need to take it. She already had the house. The house was already paid off. The car was already paid off. The kids were grown. But it was something that she wanted to do. But she accomplished all of that without a GED. Fast forward to 2022, you know, and they bought that house for like under $19,000. The kids just sold it for a little bit over $500,000. I know they got at least $400,000 or $500,000 cash. Quick settlement. And the Asian family that are in there, they where did they get their money? Boy, black people sure. Not only did they buy a, not only did they buy the goose that laid the golden egg from a black family, and no fault to them. Can't blame Asians. They got their $500,000 to buy the house cash from black women at nail salons. Urban genocide committed by black folks. The reason why I have a solution for this. All right. Is because I'm really sick and tired of black folks bitching about the white man did this and the white man did that. And they did some shit, yeah. But they didn't do this. Urban genocide, they didn't do this. The typical gambit that comes out of a black person's, on a critical mass basis, black folk basically have three chess moves when it comes to preserving the ancestral house. Preserving mama's house, granddad's house, papa's house. And here they are. Sell the property. I keep hearing that. Year after year after year after year after year. Just sell it. That's one of our gambits. The second gambit is, well, you know, get a reverse mortgage. Somebody has to pay that money back. Now, I'm going to leave the third gambit. I don't know what it could be. Just fill in the blank. But the first two, that's it. Three effing chess moves. That's it. So that's why I want to start putting information out on genocide chess. I mean, urban genocide. Once again, that has nothing to do with gun violence or physical violence. We're talking about self-inflicted financial violence. Self-inflicted within our own community. And offer, I mean, once again, we're going to model this after the chess game. Are your other options, and there are others, because it's interesting, how come white folks always find, they always find that we don't see? That's why I play, what do you call it, nine friends to the cows come home. House sitting up in the neighborhood for years, maybe sometimes decades. Then somebody comes along, buys the house on the super cheap, and it goes from house to house to house, and then the next thing you know, but once again, these Mrs. C's, her kids are straight. because Mrs. C didn't sell a house. Her kids are straight, but her grandkids are having to start from scratch. And she, Mrs. C might have a great grand or two by now. I haven't kept up with them. You know, I tend to talk to, you know, call about once a year or so and just check up on her. She's 101 now in the nursing home. But those kids got to start off from scratch. Some people say, well, they, you know, white folks got a head start. Now, see, they didn't get it. You give them a head start when you do some stupid shit like this and kill the ant. When you kill the goose that lays the generational wealth in your family. Ain't nobody kill it but you, whoever you are. Now, my solution is this. Instead of selling the house, and there's some board games that it's a board game by a guy named Robert Kiyosaki. He's got, it's two board games, Cashflow 101 and Cashflow 102. No, 202. The 202 game is about stocks, so we're not ready for that yet. We need to get you on the basics. If you type in any search engine, you type in, Cashflow board game online. They might have an online version of it. I think I saw it the other day. I've played the game 300 or 400 times, you know, the regular board game. But the fundamentals of, you copy what they do in that board game. And another reason why I play balling on Baltic so frequently is because in the chess game, I'm just saying, not chess game, the board game, the business board game, Monopoly, strip all that off and concentrate in real life. Board games are designed for you to learn financial literacy and make your mistakes in a board game so you can take those same strategies from where you make your mistakes in the board game, then you can go in the real world and you can minimize or eliminate the mistakes that you're going to make. You're going to get caught up somewhere. That's just the nature of life. But this will give you an edge. In the board game Monopoly, forget about Park Place and all these other places. Concentrate on two places. The first two squares on the Monopoly board game, and they're the purple properties, only two purple properties on the board, Baltic and Mediterranean. They're the least expensive lots on the Monopoly board game. In real life, look for the reason why I buy acres of land in rural locations, because it's Baltic and Mediterranean. In Washington, D.C., my tax bill is running about $7,000 a year. I don't even live. There's nobody even in the house. I don't put anybody in there because D.C. is too damn regulated, but that's another podcast. I got 4 acres here where my tax bill, and I paid that. I pay it late every year. It was how much I paid this year? $173. Let's round it up to $174 because it was $173 and some odd cents. So, you know, let's just make it $175 for 4 acres. Here's my strategy. Based on the fable, the goose that laid the golden egg. Instead of selling the ancestral home that you can get $500,000 or in some cases $1 million cash, I'm speaking in terms of Washington, D.C. right now in certain neighborhoods, okay, and based on a house that's right next, man, I get offers to buy that house, my house. I get postcards in here 3-4 times a month. Most of them I don't even open. I see it and I it goes into the recycle bin. I don't even open them up. Yeah, I get letters and postcards. I don't open up them, you know, none of that. So instead of selling the ancestral house, and this is why I'm recommending, get a hold of the board game Cashflow 101, by Robert Kiyosaki. You can probably get something used off of eBay at a discounted price. Because, I mean, this is why I like tiny houses. Matter of fact, I'm going to even reduce it down to a shed. I've got a mentor, he and his partner's son, it's three of them, three dudes, up in New York, Long Island, someplace like that. They took in over $700,000 last year building sheds. Backyard sheds. $700,000. Another guy I know, mentor as well, he did $2 million last year building tiny homes. So this is just one strategy. Okay, because some of the other strategies I played on here, it's a lady on here that I played her probably last week. I got to find her audio. I don't know if I can find it today. When she was facing foreclosure, the gambit that she did to save the house was she got a recipe from her grandmother on how to make cupcakes. She started with $5. $5. Her daughters did the baking. They sold the first tray. They recovered their $5 and then some, and they just kept on pouring it. But now her business is in two locations, New Orleans and Nashville, Tennessee. They do over $2 million a year selling cupcakes. In her case, the goose that laid the golden egg was a recipe that her grandmother gave to her, that her children, which is her grandmother's great-grandchildren, turned into money and saved the house from foreclosure. Those are what I call chess moves. Instead of, well, you know what, we done prayed to Jesus. Jesus hasn't performed any miracles, so let's just sell it. And I'm just tired of hearing that record over. I mean, every year I hear it. But so I'm figuring there's got to be some type of information abyss out here where you know, we need to just catch up on stuff. Okay, my board's a little frozen here, so bear with me. This board's got a mind of its own. Well, my board sticks. So I can't go to the phone calls just yet, but we're going to go to them. But anyway, so look, for people out there that might have a financial situation, all right, sit down with a pen and paper and write, list it 1 through 10. Matter of fact, you know what, not even going that far. Donald Trump in his first book, The Art of the Deal, somebody bought that for me as a birthday present many years ago, when it first got out, actually. And the best thing I got out of that book was he says when he has a problem to solve, he takes out a piece of paper and pen or whatever, and he writes out 6 possible strategies, or in using chess terms, gambits, in which he might be able to solve that problem. And I've been, when I come across problems like that, as we all do, I do the same thing. And seldom have I had reached have had to go for the fifth or sixth solution. So I just want people, because, you know, you got white folks who, I mean, it's not restricted to color or race, but it just, I got fed up with basically what has happened to D.C. Because, you know what, it's just not D.C. because we typically just have three moves in our repertoire. Just three. When there's so many other possibilities that are available to solve that problem. So, thus, gentrification, Jeff, and the geese, you can breed your own geese. The cupcake lady, her goose, or now she's got geese, once again was a recipe given to her by her grandmother. Now, an example of her killing a goose that laid the golden egg would have been if she had just balled up and torn up the recipe and never used it. That's one way of using it. Or she's got two businesses now in two different cities here in the United States in some kind of way maliciously, you know, ran those into the ground. But now she's got two geese that I know about. So my whole thing is become a goose farmer. Start breeding geese. What is a geese? Really, it's an asset, an income-producing asset. All right, if you don't want to bake cookies or cupcakes, fine. If you want to cut grass, fine. If you want to shovel snow and have a show snowing business, fine. If you want to build bridges or stadiums, fine. But it'll be nice not to just have one goose, but have you a flock of geese, and every one of those geese are laying eggs. And then, you know, you won't be selling yourself out through what I call, once again, you know, we may as well call this familial genocide. Because that's what it is. Families killing themselves financially by killing the goose that laid the generational wealth egg.
I'll say some shit to y'all that I seen yesterday that made me smile, but it hurt me to my heart. There's a house next door to me that's been abandoned, and the yard, the grass, high as hell and everything. There's a couple of abandoned cars out there beside the house. Well, yesterday I get off work about 7 o'clock. A Mexican guy pulled up. He said, "These your cars?" I said, "No." He said, "I just bought this house, man." I said, "All right, that's what's up." He was like, "You know whose cars these is?" He said, "No." He said, "Well, I bought the house, not the cars." Okay, I'm like, cool. I'm thinking he's just coming to look at the house. I go back in the house, do a little straighten up. I swear to God, I walk back at the house. Now, I'm getting off about 7:20. It's fucking 9 Mexican trucks just pulled up. They got fucking beer, lights, and shit, right? So I'm like, what y'all finna do? He said, "We finna fix this house." I said, "What kind of crew you got working after 7 o'clock? He said, "These my friends." The fucking house is fixed this morning. They went in there and drywalled that fucking house. Wow. I just left out of there. It was a fucking abandoned house. That bitch looked new this morning. Whew. It was an abandoned fucking house. And it looked new this morning. It's an old African proverb. Many hands make light work. I just don't think they're better than us. I just think we won't do nothing together. Wow. You're not hearing what the fuck I'm saying. It was an abandoned house yesterday at 7:15. That bitch is new this morning. He bought a tax lien house. I can't wait to see what they do. I can't wait to see, is one family gonna live in there? Is they gonna, I'm gonna get to know the motherfuckers. You best believe me, when I make some money, I'm gonna do it. I'm gonna bring us together. And I'm not fucking with a lot of people.
People keep talking about how the world is going to come to an end. And I wonder, in these days and these times, if anybody likes to say,
is anybody
people keep talking about how society is falling down today. And as hard as I try not to listen just to what them folks got to say, but you know, I just can't help but look around and see we digging our own grave. And there's just one thing I want to know. Can anybody be saved?
Getting sick and tired of you, Lamar Johnson. I really am. It doesn't make any sense. You need to go ahead and tell these people you took their money. Okay? Stop stringing people along and just admit the fact that you yourself have stolen these people's money. You have. No announcement? Nothing. Now we're blaming the moon for the reason why you...
Okay, all right. Can't find the audio I was looking for. All right, well, anyway, I did my little rant on gentrification chess. Become a goose farmer where you're raising through a you know what, the Amish and the Mennonite are good examples of this. Many of those families, particularly in the Amish community, they have family-based businesses. You know, the wives, they could be baking baked goods, shoe fire pliers, rolls, buns, bread, the assortment of cakes and cookies, pies, other than shoe fly pie, you know, jellies, jams, what have you. And, you know, that's part of the family business. The husband and sons, they might be furniture makers or cabin builders, you know, or something, that, you know, building barns or something of that nature. So, you know, most Amish, I don't know about Mennonite, although Mennonites are representative, but they have family-based businesses. So if they have... if they need money for whatever particular reason, they're going to build an asset. And once again, the definition of asset is something valuable that you can make and sell. All right. They're not going out and getting a job, and I'm not knocking people that go out and get jobs, or particularly second or third jobs or what have you. I'm not knocking that at all. I'm just saying they have a very efficient way of keeping solvent. And sustainable. I mean, who makes more money? The person who goes to work at a bakery or the baker who owns the bakery? Who owns more money? The person who goes to work as a carpenter working for somebody who makes tiny houses or sheds or furniture, or the person who owns the company. So, and you know what? Not everybody's cut out to be an entrepreneur. Not everybody's cut out to be a very good employee. So there's something out there for everybody. But there, you know what? It before I go to the phone lines here. And that's another reason why I'm using the chess game as an analogy. The all right, and you can look it up along with me. Number of spaces, because I'm looking at my new next door neighbors, which they got their cash money to buy a house for over $500,000 through a nail salon. And I have yet to see every nail salon that I've seen, and I do, I've traveled as much as anybody else, I think. Every nail salon that I've noticed Well, you know what? There's an exception for maybe two. But every nail salon that I've seen in the D.C. metro area, Detroit metro area, in certain neighborhoods here in Florida, the primary clientele of a lot of these Asian nail salon operators are black folk, black women. Now, once again, white women have their nails done too. I'm just saying what I've noticed. Okay, so number of what we're looking at is, because I want people to start opening up your mind. You know, I'm tired of people, particularly black folks, sell it. No. Think, man, you know what, there's a movie, today's Friday. I'm going to make it a movie day because, you know, man, I got to prepare for a vlog at 3. But after that vlog at 3, you know, I'm going to watch, and I recommend it, The Life of a King. I think that's the name of it. It's based on a true story by Cuba Jr. Hold on, before I go into that, Number Spaces on Chessboard. Okay. All right, there's 64 squares. 64 squares on the chessboard. All right. And the chessboard represents the landscape. So we have to think, we got to, once again, is that your go-to thing? Is it sell something? I mean, sell the house? That's the go-to. That's the only move that a lot of people come up with. Now, okay. So going back to chess, there's 64 squares on the board. And once again, I have this in the program notes. Just starting out the game before any move has been made, there are 20 possible legal moves to be made. Sit, if you're in dire straits, and this is why we want to have Zoom meetings to figure out, to help people at no charge. We want to have Zoom meetings where, at no charge, teaching people, or doing the best we can, because it'll be a mastermind type thing. You know, all right, what? You're in dire straits. Okay, let's look at the landscape. Just like the chessboard, all right, there's 64 spaces. What kind of space do you have available on your landscape? All right, you got to look at the landscape. You got to know the lay of the land for it. Number two is, all right, one of the moves that you cannot bring to the table is selling the ancestral home. That's a non-negotiable. We're sitting here to figure out what other legal moves you can make to get the house in financial straight with the government and, you know, with everybody, and then you can live your best life. Now, life, in my opinion, mirrors the chessboard or the game of chess. So, okay, once again, the standard things I've heard are sell a house, get a reverse mortgage. I'm leaving the third option, some of you out, fill in the blank. Typically, people just have three options. No, that's all they can see with their mind. I want to get it so you can open up your mind where it's infinite. Like, you know, all right, so those three, reverse mortgage, the selling the house, ancestral house, and whatever you came up with, those are not on the board. So we know that just on the first move, you've got 17 other possibilities. So let's write them down. What are the 17 other possibilities that you do have? You'll surprise yourself. And out of that 17 possibilities, you only need one of them to work. All right. The next statistic from the chessboard, after two moves, there are 400 possibilities. Sit down with a piece. Think on paper. Don't get all upset. You know, don't panic. Don't drink. Don't stress yourself out. Get quiet. Sit down with a piece of paper or whatever you're going to write with and, you know, think. And if you can't think of 400 legal possibilities, you know what? Get on a phone call with your family and friends, and more than likely your family and friends don't know. You're more than likely you've gone to them already, and none of anything they mentioned didn't work out anyway. They probably said, well, sell it. Then get online, man. You got social media. Facebook alone has a billion people that you can ask questions to. And it's only 365 days in a year. And you only need to get one right answer. But go after, if you can't get anything after the first 17 to 20, then okay. And here's the beauty of it now. Here's the beauty of it. Now, when the game starts, you got 20 possibilities. Now, after the second move, you got 400 possibilities, and after the fourth move, you got 197,742 possibilities. Now, here's how this works. Your odds and your possibilities for success and overcoming your problem don't happen until you make that first move. You don't get the 20 possibilities until you make that first move. And you don't get the opportunity of the 400 possible moves until you make your second legal move. The more legal moves you make, your possibilities increase. Don't worry about you trying to come up with the ideas. Just make the move, and then the right person, the right circumstance, or what the right whatever that guides you to your next step will appear. See, a lot of us get caught up with, I need to figure this whole thing out from A to Z. No. Just like when we're learning how to spell. They start us off with the alphabet. They don't give us a copy of War and Peace in kindergarten, nursery school, or first grade. No. Let's get the alphabet down first. Let's get the A's through Z's down first. And then after you got that down, okay, then, you know, all right, here's a book, Dr. Seuss. All right, first page, hop. Second page, pop, with, you know, illustrated, of course. Third page, on. All right, then the fourth page, hop, on, pop, you've learned a sentence. Same thing with this. Okay, start with the fundamentals. Okay, And you know what? As you learn the fundamentals and you learn the landscape and you learn what, you know, what you know what? Here's another thing. On the first move, you got 20 possibilities. You know what? Study those 20 possibilities. Don't try to learn 197,000 gambits or possibilities. No, no. Stick with the fundamentals. Because, it's you know what, just like chicken. There's a book I saw a number of years ago. You can probably get it online. And there are probably different versions of it now written by different people. But the book was titled 365 Ways to, you know, to cook chicken. You know, barbecue chicken, fried chicken, lemon chicken, Szechuan chicken, sweet and sour chicken. I say sesame chicken already. Chicken and rice, chicken and dumplings, smothered chicken. I mean, we can go on, man. Okay. Just one bird. Just one bird. All right. Chicken nuggets, you know, chicken sandwich, then, the, you know, Chipotle chicken sandwich. I mean, Peruvian chicken, Dominican chicken, Kung Pao chicken. So it's the same thing with any type of financial situation that you're dealing with. All right. Get the fundamentals. Sit down and think on paper. All right. Don't be afraid to ask for help in helping you think. But sit down and what are 20 ways that I can tackle that? And as you implement, once again, now out of the 20 possibilities, you can only make, you got to select one of those moves. If we're talking about a legal game of chess. But after you make that legal move, okay, then your possibilities increase. Once again, after two moves, you've gone from nothing to 400 possibilities. And you only need one. You only need one to solve your particular problem. So that's a two-pronged solution that I've thrown out here on gentrification, what I call urban genocide. Urban genocide meaning that, okay, don't sell the ancestral house, but here's some strategies that you can explore, and you don't have to sell grandma's house, and you don't have to put a reverse mortgage on the house. My mother passed away 3 years ago, but she demonstrated this. Now, she was a registered nurse. That was her main, you know, bread and butter when she was working. And when her and her husband, stepbrother, moved, and you know their retirement and whatnot, he passed away at his second year down there. And she found out the week that he passed away that there was a mortgage on the house. She thought that he bought the house free and clear, which he did. But he had a son that needed to start over, you know, because his son was losing his house and foreclosed. So he took out a loan on the house in order to help his son. There's absolutely nothing wrong with that. But she didn't know it until after he passed away. So she was retired by then. So, but she was in good health. So her strategy, because she could have sold the house. She could have sold the roof over her head. But what she did, well, she came out of retirement and got back into nursing clients in the new, you know, retirement place where they were at. And in no time at all, the house was paid off. That was her chess gambit. No, working. Now, another one, and I'll go to the phone lines, was my mother. The ancestral houses in New Orleans, at least one of them, one of her sisters took out a reverse mortgage. A questionable reverse mortgage, too, but I'm not going to hear no dirty laundry out here. They're all gone anyway. So my mother found out about it, and she wrote a check for $90,000 to retire the debt. She had another sister that actually had power of attorney of the house at that time. She had another sister that said, just sell the house. And that was an ancestral house where her parents, my grandparents, raised them. And one of my cousins and her children were living in the house. But my mother didn't believe in killing the goose that laid the generational wealth golden egg. She had a sizable bank account and wrote a check for $90,000 and didn't have to come out of retirement to do it. On a critical mass basis, black folk, in my opinion, and I'm just one person, we have to stop killing the goose that lays the generational wealth eggs in our family. So, anyway, more on that. We'll pop up something next week on that. That's my take on gentrification chess, making your own golden goose that will lay its own golden eggs. 314, your mic is open.
Well, L.A., you called me in the middle of doing some computations right here.
Okay.
But where is the lady that was on yesterday?
I don't know where she's at today.
Yeah, she had some really good points yesterday.
I'm supposed to call her at 3:00, but I don't know where she's at right now. Robin's running errands on the West Coast.
Oh, man, it's 11:31. I started listening to you about 10:00. You been talking that long?
Yeah, I went on a long rant today.
Well, we might as well let you get off. You could probably save a few pennies. Hell, you don't want to pass overtime already.
Oh, no, I'm good. If you got a comment, we got time for that. The time's paid for already.
Well, you hit on so much, I really don't know what to comment on. Mm. And something that I wanted to so far back, I forgot it.
Well, I don't forgot it, too. All right, well,
but how's
we'll
your
hold
property
over
doing down in Florida?
We'll be making videos. We did our first one yesterday, so we're going to put that in there. So hopefully by the end of this month, you'll see some video on that.
All right, yeah, I was having great expectations. I was even telling
We just did a video yesterday, so we agreed on a set number. I don't want to put that number out there, but we did one yesterday, and then we're talking about it, because to do 100 videos. But that'll be part of it, though.
That was a good talk you had. I listened.
Okay. All right, you have a good weekend. All right, if no other friends raised up, we'll adjourn for the day. I'll give you 5 seconds. Five, 4, if you got any comments. 3, okay, well, everyone have a good weekend. Have a safe weekend. I got a video to do at 3. So on that note, everyone have a good rest of the day.